You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Editor-in-Chief Rob Weinert-Kent, and I'm here with...
Associate Editor Deep Tran.
And...
Managing Editor Russ Denben.
And
Susie was supposed to be with us today, and then she got sick.
Thanks for stepping in, Russ.
Sure thing, anytime.
So we have a couple topics today. We are going to talk about one of our most popular pieces we've ever run, I think. Deep's piece about Miss Saigon. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the state of criticism, a perennial topic, but there's new things to talk about, new initiatives, new movement on that front. And then we'll have a report from the Humana Festival in Louisville by David Lohr of 2AMT, 2AM Theater fame. He lives in Madison, Indiana, which is not too far from Humana and or from Actors Theater Louisville, and he's gone for several years. He's going to file a report from the field that'll be in the middle of our show today with some interviews, and so that'll be worth listening to. Let's dive right in. So Deep, let's just talk about it's a piece that was sort of long anticipated once we heard that Miss Saigon was coming back to Broadway. And it's a piece that's in dialogue sort of with a lot of issues that you brought up, but it's a and also with your coverage of Queen's play Queen Wen's play Viet Gone. But why don't you talk a little bit about this piece and your how the response to it?
Sure. Well, as a Vietnamese American person who likes the theater, I usually I've been asked a few times what I think of this particular show. Mm-hmm. And I didn't grow up seeing it. I only knew of it because Lea Salonga was in it. But even when I was young and reading the summary of Miss Saigon, I was just thinking, that does not sound like a good idea. It just doesn't. I think because, like, I grew up with very strong women in my family. I'm the youngest of four girls, and my mom is, like, a very, like, She keeps my dad on a leash, and it's fantastic. So, like, I don't identify with the weak Asian female trope, and so seeing it in 2017 on the largest theater platform in America, and knowing that it's going to tour, and knowing that it's still being produced, you just think, can we have a conversation about this? Especially because the Vietnam War is just such a big part of the American imagination, but no one ever really asked me about what my experiences were or what Vietnamese people's experiences were and how it's really represented in American culture through a very American-centric viewpoint, which I understand because, you know, we live in America and it really screwed up a lot of people's and it's very contentious. So I understand that. But at the same time, you know, 3 million Vietnamese people died in the war and compared to what, 50,000 American soldiers. And so you just think maybe we should have a conversation. And also, it was seeing it on stage. Okay, well, first, I saw it in the Lincoln Central Library with Jonathan Price when I was researching my article on Broadway's Yellow Fever in 2015. And then the Yellow Face was very uncomfortable, but so towards the end, like, I was kind of fast-forwarding through the entire thing because I just wanted it to be over. Mm-hmm. But it was also the fact that I don't like seeing Asian people on screen who hate being Asian. That's not a very empowering thing to watch. And also seeing, like, a person who abuses, like, fragile Vietnamese women and gets...
We're talking about the engineer here.
Yeah, we're talking about the engineer. Yeah. And he abuses these women, and yet the audience is supposed to find him appealing in some way?
Right.
Or laugh along with his jokes? Like, it's gross. It's not a comfortable experience, and seeing it on a stage with other people around me recently, with people laughing at his jokes, while at the same time he's the actor playing the engineer is like pulling the actress who plays Kim's hair and pushing her around, and then you just think, why is this appealing? Why are we lifting this up as the biggest portrayal of Vietnamese Americans, Vietnamese people, Asian people currently in America right now?
Right.
So those were all of my feelings, and I just kind of put it in there and hoped that people would, understand, but just to have a different viewpoint, because I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. So those are my thoughts.
You spoke very movingly about your own family story as well. Your father having fought for the South Vietnamese Army and then being imprisoned after the war, and your mother visiting him in a gulag, basically, right?
Yeah.
What was it, once a week for a couple hours? Was that the whole?
No, once a month to every
once
2 months,
month.
Because they had, in order to visit him, she had to have paperwork and she had to pay the communists in order to visit him.
Right.
And so she didn't always have money to visit him. And so it's a whole big thing.
Right.
Yeah. But the point I wanted to make with that was not to say, this is my family story, you should produce it, or
right,
give me a book
right.
deal. It was more like, there's just so many courageous, Vietnamese people are courageous and we're
right.
resilient people, but we'll never get to be seen like that. And especially with Miss Saigon and, you know, Apocalypse Now and Platoon and all those things, like we're just faceless people who are just waiting for Americans to save us or kill us.
Well, here's what's interesting is I was thinking about it. The comparison of those movies is true that those movies literally don't center Vietnamese. They don't really have
yes.
any Vietnamese characters with names, most of those films, those Vietnam films. And what's different about Miss Saigon, of course, is that it does have major
mm-hmm.
Vietnamese characters,
mm-hmm.
but they're told in this way, which is, you know, problematic, let's say, and by two French guys. And the French have their history with, and then it's sort of a very English production. So, I mean, as you probably know, there's a lot of Asian Americans who relish the employment they've had, right?
Yeah.
Leah Salonga, you had a great interview with her for that piece you did, which I highly recommend people, if they like Deep's piece, look up her piece on Broadway's Yellow Fever. Sort
That's
of an inflammatory title for something which is, you know, Broadway's history of depiction of Asians and Asian Americans.
And we'll include a link.
Yeah, we'll include a link to that. And there's also not just a affection for of people who've been in it, but Asian Americans for seeing themselves at all.
Yeah.
But I think that we've come a ways in 30 years since then, and it does seem like it's probably time for new representations, right?
I think so. And the thing is, like, just because it's the rare time we're being portrayed as any leading characters doesn't mean, like, we can't have a conversation about the way it's happening.
Of course. Yeah, no. That.
And so I think, like, we haven't been able to have that conversation just because there's Asian Americans are still fighting to be represented at all. And so they think, oh, it's Miss Saigon. You really can't criticize it because, you know, it's the only time we get employed. So just, you know, be happy with that.
Right. Well, as a friend of mine pointed out, like, what's really fucked up is that if it weren't for that show, there'd be hardly any Asian Americans on Broadway this season, which is messed up. So
it is.
That's not a defense of the show, but were you, was anything about the response? I mean, it was mostly, we didn't have a lot of the trolls come out. But in general, were you heartened by the response? Anything about the response surprised you deep?
For the most part, yeah, I was surprised there wasn't as much negativity. I really can't figure out why, aside from a lot of people telling me it really is, it's not a good show to begin with, so it's not something that, you know, it wasn't a classic to begin with, so we can talk about it. So that was great. And Pulitzer winner Viet Thanh Nguyen, who I interviewed in the article, he won last year for his novel, The Sympathizer. Like, he's offering, he wants to reprint it on his website as well. So that was a very, you know, that was a very heartwarming, validating moment for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've gotten the critical comments I received are people saying that it's just one story.
Sure.
And so why are you upset over this one story? But I just think, like, it's never just, microaggressions aren't just one thing. They're an accumulation of things. And so it is about Miss Saigon, but it really is, but it's also about, like, Americans wanting to center themselves in all narratives, even the ones that aren't about them or isn't appropriate for them to be in the narrative. Like, that was the point.
And, right. It's not like you singled out some tiny play in a black box theater no one's ever heard of. It's like, it's just one story, and it's the story that's being told about Vietnam especially in the theater. I think that's why it's so heartening to see Queez play, which, if there were any justice, would be on Broadway as well.
I think that's part of why I'm kind of a little bit upset, because it's like, yes, Queez play is getting produced this season, but it's not getting produced on Broadway. Like, why is that? And why is it that the one time Asian Americans are employed, it's in this thing that makes them look like victims or really horrible people? Victims, which everybody's the horrible people in that show particularly, but I'd rather be the white dude in that story, really, because at least he gets to go back to America with his wife and, you know, half Asian child and live like a happy life.
But he feels really bad.
But he feels really bad.
What are you going to say, Russ?
As you said earlier, Deep, it's really about wondering why this particular show is being lifted up in 2017 as the sole story on Broadway depicting Vietnamese Americans.
We have to also wonder about, like, when you think about why the question of why to bring back a show, and this is a show about America's in a war zone,
right?
With lots of refugees. Does this show speak in any interesting way to the moment which we're in right now? I don't know that the creators have really thought that through. I don't know if anyone sees Syrians in this show, or, you know. Anyway, I might be going far afield there, but I feel like those are the questions that you bring to a show like this in 2017.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, and I don't know, because I think we've all seen, well, Russ and I have both seen a production. So, like, did you think it talked about refugees in a way that made people want to bring them over?
No, I sense that the people who enjoy this production viewed it as escapism.
Yeah.
They were not viewing it as a lens for our times.
Right, right. Definitely read it if you haven't, and tell us what you think of it, and look at our other pieces on this topic. We also have some pieces up, just a news release that just came out as we're taping, about American Theater has teamed with the O'Neill Theater Institute's National Critics Institute. It's the O'Neill Theater Center's National Critics Institute. Each July, which is it's a 2-week workshop, in which critics from all over are flown in to basically work on their craft, talk about the business, talk about their craft. Deep, you've been to it. Susie's been to it. Allison's going to go this year. I think Russ and I are the only ones who haven't been. In any case,
it's a magical 2 weeks.
So they
are stressful.
They are making room at this year's conference and going forward, as far as we know, for whomever we select as our arts journalist of color in TCG's Rising Leaders of Color program. It's a little complicated. There's a lot of words to explain that, but basically TCG has a program where they identify and nurture early career theater makers and theater leaders. They call it Rising Leaders of Color. And this year we thought, well, we would like to expand and diversify the critical talent pool for reasons which should be obvious to anyone looking at the masthead of American theater or the New York Times or any place. We've talked about it before, how the theater field that we cover has become much more diverse, even for all its problems, than the people covering it. So for that reason, we thought, why don't we find a way within the Rising Leaders of Color to say, hey, journalists are leaders too. So alongside directors, playwrights, designers, other theater makers who are part of Rising Leaders of Color, there's going to be openings for arts journalists as well to apply. And that program will include convenings throughout the year, webinars, other resources for early career theater leaders of color. And one of the benefits that's unique to the arts journalist person who gets selected is going to be this Critics Institute. That's a lot of verbiage to say. Basically,
it's a good opportunity.
It's a good opportunity. The only catches are that the Rising Leaders of Color program, it's built around each year's TCG conference. So last year it was DC Leaders of Color, DC metro area. This year it's in Portland, Oregon. So it's going to be, applicants are going to be from the Oregon State. Next year it would be St. Louis. This is one way. This is not the only way American Theater and TCG hope to help diversify the talent pool. But this is our sort of beachhead, our sort of opening salvo in trying to do that. And I think I've said this before, geographic diversity is, you know, nearly as important to me. And certainly at American Theater, it's as important. It's one of the main values is to cover the whole country and to help journalism markets where outside of the major cities are much more depressed and there's not enough opportunity for anyone, let alone writers of color. So we'll, you know, the conference is done in a different city each year. We know next year's in St. Louis. I don't know after that what we're going to do. And hopefully we'll build up these and nurture these writers. Let them know, whether or not we can give them a job here immediately. Let them know that there is a place to be published. There is a community that wants to read what they have to say. There's theater worth covering. Theater's really exciting and interesting to cover. It's part of the conversation. So, that's my spiel. I probably said enough. We want to talk about other things around that. Like, obviously, one of the recent pieces of news we didn't talk about was Jesse Green's hiring to replace Charles Isherwood at the New York Times. Jesse Green, despite the sound of his name, is a white man. Some people are like, Jesse, is that a girl? No, it's a guy.
I thought you were going to say he's a green man, not a white man. I was like, no, that can't be.
Oh, Russ.
like, that doesn't make any sense.
No.
It's like dad jokes, the podcast.
Yeah.
At least Rob's a dad, so he can get away with it.
I know. Yeah.
Wanna be dad, Russ.
So, yeah.
Someday.
In any case, we didn't talk about that, but that was another thing in which there's been some interesting conversation about that. I did an interview with Jesse, but there's also been a conversation at Exeunt magazine.
Exeunt.
I don't know how to say that. About, you know, just the sense that this is a, in a way, a missed opportunity to make a different choice. I mean, the Times, I think one of the key things, the last thing I'll say, and then I'll let the other people speak. When I talked to Jesse, one of the most telling things I think he said was that the focus on the Times creates huge distortions and unfairnesses. And just the fact that everyone's focused on this, this is for artists and the way they're covered, and this is for journalists and the opportunities they have. The Times, that's not exculpatory. That's not like the Times does have to take responsibility for those unfairnesses that their huge power creates. But I mean, I don't know. It's something I think that Jesse is at least aware of that, you know, of that position.
I don't know. It's one of those things where I see both sides of it. I see executive leadership at the Times wanting to say, no, we need the best writers here. So therefore, Jesse Green's one of the best critics working right now. I concede that point. But at the same time, I feel like it was a missed opportunity because there are so many younger female critics who are just waiting in the wings who have been groomed.
Mm-hmm.
To that position, and to have it taken away by someone who didn't even apply for it is incredibly unfair and incredibly deceptive to people who say, oh, just wait until, you know, it's like, you're not ready now, just wait 10 years, just do the work, and eventually you'll get there. Well, you wait 10 years, you do the work, and when the opportunity comes, you don't get it. And so you just think, is that always going to be the case? And like, you cannot solve diversity issues with one hire, but at the same time, you have to start somewhere.
Right.
Yes.
And so I've been feeling a lot of things about that, but bringing it back to our conversation about the leaders of color, like, I think there's more conversation now around mentoring and around, like, giving opportunities for younger writers to rise in the ranks. And I'm really happy that we've been able to we're able to do something like this and to give writers a platform. I think all of us here are still trying to, like, you know, treat our writers better, increase their fees, and make more room for them, and find them if we don't know they're there. Like, we're all always on the lookout for younger writers whose voices we can help amplify. But I've been feeling really... there's like three separate thoughts and like one big thing.
All right. Yeah, go for it.
But at the same time, like, yes, there's American theater. But where else can they go? And so, like, I guess this is more like a call to other theater publications, like a call to places like The Times, like Playbill, like Theater Mania, yes, we're helping foster these people, but maybe you can help too and right. give them opportunity. Maybe also do theater criticism. And for publications that don't pay their writers right now, like, maybe find some way to pay your writers and to get advertisers so you can at least give your contributors something, because I don't actually believe writing for free is a very useful pastime. But maybe that makes me sound elitist. I don't know.
No. That's my answer. I mean, you know, I think everyone has to write for free at some point. You have to write for, you know, to learn, but that shouldn't become a permanent place where people work. Russ?
And to your point about our desire and others' desire to nurture young writers of color, we don't want folks waiting around for the grant to come mm-hmm. to your for the opportunity to come to your area. We are actively pursuing theater journalists, arts journalists of marginalized groups. So if there is somebody who is not yet writing for American Theater or similar publications, please send them our way.
Yeah. Or
please email us.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, yes. I want to encourage people to pitch us and also to promote their favorite writers to us. Again, I made this pitch before that, I think the onus is very much on gatekeepers like the New York Times, like ourselves, to bring people in and take risks and prioritize this and make conscious effort. But I think we could use help finding these voices and also helping them lift them up. If you see a piece as good as Deep's piece about Miss Saigon, send it our way. We want to read it. We read a lot of the publications out there, HowlRound and the other theater publications and other places that where it just pops up. So randomly there'll be a story in Financial Times or a story in the Atlantic. And we try to aggregate these and share them on our Facebook page. I've made a real commitment to trying to share more pieces that I read in all different areas that I write, that I'm reading. Share them, call out the writer's name, and just let people know it's out there. Point them. I mean, in my own little way, I have I can be a curator of this stuff, and then in a big way here as an employer, I can do that as well.
And I don't know. I've been struggling lately because I taught a workshop the other week, and it was a workshop for young female writers or potential writers who are interested in writing about theater, and they're asking me about, if you don't live in a big market like New York with its own arts publication, then what do you do? And so I've been trying to figure out what the answer to that is. And I think a lot of publications are trying to figure out the answer because it's not a theater. Writing about theater is not as stable a profession as it used to be. And so people are trying to figure out like how they can monetize it in some ways that will make it more sustainable for the people who write about it. And so I'm wondering like what the answer is to that. Like, is it just more artistic institutions like funding their own publications? Is it just more blogs where you have to write for free as a pastime and that's going to be the new reality? Like, I prefer the former, really, but I don't know what the answer is.
There are a lot of models that people have kicked around. John Moore in Denver is a good example, who used to be the Denver Post critic and now writes for the Denver Center Performing Arts. He writes for their blog. He writes, still does a lot of journalism.
No, they keep him busy.
There's plenty of communication he has to do. That, I mean, in a way, that's crossing over, and he's not doing, I mean, what worries me the most, and this includes in New York and everywhere, is this like criticism. Again, I have a column about this. Criticism is what formed me and my sensibility. I'm not alone. There's a whole generation and generations of people who were formed by criticism. And I'm concerned. This is a concern at TCG too, because American theater is funded by the theater field. So the amount of criticism we can do, outright criticism, and I mean saying, which is not just saying bad stuff, but being free to say bad stuff, being free to give our subjective reading of what's out there, is limited. It's limited by any funding model. It's limited by even in a free market by what the public wants to read. Does the public want to read theater reviews? That's why Backstage West got rid of them. But we're getting back into the conversation we've had before. I don't know the answer to the arts writer in a small community. I think by calling it arts writer, that's one of my clues, is you can't just write about theater. You got to write about all kinds of stuff.
Yes.
Write about culture. Be engaged with your culture. I will say money is important, and money is, you know, keeps the lights on, keeps us all fed. But the reason, you know, money is for us to do things with, which is includes culture. And, you know, if you're in a situation where you can enjoy great culture, whether you're being paid to write about it or not, if you're being paid somehow, somewhere, and you can still enjoy good culture wherever you live, I think that's the end goal. Is to see and think about culture. And if you can build an economy around that and get paid to write about it, you know, that's gravy. You know, I kind of feel like you have to pursue it the same way that artists do. I mean, I really do think this is like artists. Artists have to pursue it for its own sake. And if they can find a way to build an economy around it and be supported in that, then that's great. And we should support that. But it has to be about the passion to either make the art or write about the art or share it with others. That has to be the driver, I think, you know.
I think maybe it's like the nuts and bolts of it needs to be, let's say one, you start an arts blog where you and a bunch of your friends get together and write about the arts in your town.
Yes.
Two, you write about a show. Three, you send that review to the theater that it concerns and other theaters around in your town. And then four, hopefully they click on it, they share it, which then brings viewers into your site. And maybe at that point, five, you have advertisers on your site, either from Google or from your own advertisers, where those clicks will get you like a couple of dollars. It's not a lot, but it's something. And so like the more you do that and the more theaters share those articles, good or bad, with their readers, means the more clicks you get on your website, which means you get a little bit more money. And so I think the point I'm trying to get at is theaters, freaking share stuff. share good reviews and share bad reviews, and also share theater coverage about theaters that may not be your own. So that at the end of the day, like, you're helping support it too, and you're helping draw attention to the work of arts journalists, and then maybe they'll get paid a little bit more and they'll be able to keep on giving you coverage.
Right. Another thing you can do is do podcasts. I'm trying to segue to our David Lohr section. David Lohr does a lot of podcasts. I think a lot of them are about culture and about pop culture as well as theater. Now we'd like to share with you David Lohr's report from the Actors Theater of Louisville's Humana Festival of New Plays. Dave, over to you.
I'm David J. Lohr, playwright and, I guess, ringleader of 2AM Theater, and American Theater asked me to visit the Humana Festival this year. I live right outside Louisville, Kentucky, so I've been to a lot of Humana Festivals in the last 20 years, and it's been fascinating to watch it grow and evolve and change and to see the plays go off into the world and develop and change from here. But it's been especially fascinating to watch in the last few years under the artistic leadership of Les Waters. This year's plays ranged from Cry It Out, about mothers dealing with the first year of parenthood, to We're Gonna Be Okay, about two families facing an actual nuclear holocaust at the beginning of the 1960s, or an alternate 1960s, and slowly going stir-crazy in a bomb shelter they share, from Recent Alien Abductions, which takes the tropes and techniques of shows like The X-Files and applies them to a horrific story of another kind entirely, to I Now Pronounce You, about a Jewish wedding gone horribly, horribly wrong. I took a few minutes to speak with Les Waters and ask him about both the festival itself this year and his production of recent alien abductions.
So this has been a wonderful festival year so far. What is it about these plays this year that attracted you and the staff?
Well, what is it that attracted us? Well, we never program thematically. I mean, I think everybody mistakenly thinks we do.
Right.
You know, because when you're watching them, themes start to appear. They're bound to, there are six plays in rotation.
Right. And when you're seeing them all in 48 hours.
Yeah, so the people think, oh, there they go. They put these plays together and they're in dialogue and they must have done it deliberately. So these themes are appearing. And that isn't the case, and it's never been the case, and we tend to be surprised when people say, oh, look, you're talking about this or you're talking about that. So I'm always very thrilled when people see something appear. No, it's mainly it's enthusiasm when we're putting them together. You know, we're thrilled when we find a writer whose work we don't know, so Chelsea's play Airness was new to all of us. Molly Smith Metzler's play Cry It Out is a commission that came through. I think actually what's interesting for us is we have a series of plays that are ensemble plays this year. There isn't, now I think I'm correct in there, a play that's constructed around one central character. That they're all, in every single case, a play about a group of people dealing with something which we weren't aware of when we were, making the festival. That's interesting. But it's mainly just the passion for the plays and making sure we have a diversity of voices there.
Mm. Well, and that's one thing this year especially. There's been a much more diverse group of playwrights than usual at the festival.
Thank you.
It's lovely to see. What can you tell us about recent Alien Abductions, which is the one you've directed this year?
Well, I've known Jorge socially for some years. I mean, my friend Sarah Rule, who is a playwright I've worked with several times, introduced me to Jorge and to his work, and was, in fact, the person who connected me to Jorge in this instance and said, you know, Jorge has written this play, Recent Alien Abductions, and you should read it. I love the play. I find the play very surprising and the turns that it takes, and I find it a very moving play, both personally and politically. I mean, I think the play is about gaslighting, how one person or a political system persuades other people that its system is actually the correct one and denies other people experiences. But the fact that it's the lens that it views it through initially is an episode of The X-Files.
Hmm.
And then it shifts to Puerto Rico and is talking about Puerto Rico independence, Puerto Rico's relationship with America, very surprising. And I love the form of the play and the challenges of the play. So I've been very honored to work with him, and I think it's an extraordinary piece of writing.
Hmm. One thing that I've been talking with people who've come regularly for years and years, they've all mentioned the pacing of shows that you've directed and how tight the pacing is, and just that it's always lovely work, which I agree with. How do you approach that? How do you look at the script and say, okay, this, you know, how does that evolve as you're directing it?
Oh, that's a really interesting observation. I, you know, before I got into the theatre, my background as a child was I was a singer. So I had musical training as a child, and I probably listened to plays rhythmically.
Okay.
So I think that probably informs my work. And some of my plays, the productions in the Humana over the years, I'm thinking now of Chuck Mee's Glory of the World that I did here, was a kind of rather wild, extravagant piece that started in silence, exploded in the middle, and then went back to silence. And as a director myself, I do like a challenge, and Jorge's play unravels at a much steadier, controlled pace. It's a very tense play, and that's part of the challenge of doing it at the speed that it unravels. That you know something explosive is going to happen in the middle of it. So it really the tempo of the play is very crucial to it, and I'm glad people observe that. I mean, I hope it's not in the forefront of it. I hope they're not watching the technique.
No. I mean, these are people who go to theater a lot. Right, I mean, it's not just this isn't Joe audience member.
Right, but yes, I'm very aware of that when I'm working on something.
Okay. Now, what of the other plays have you enjoyed? Were you tempted to want to direct any of the other ones?
No. I mean, I like all of the other ones, but no. I mean, I'm very proud of the work, but Jorge's play was the one that I thought my skills would be best served with this.
Okay. How do you pair playwrights and directors?
Well, some, you know, sometimes playwrights come and they their plays have gone through workshops, or and the directors have been attached to those workshops, or playwrights have been writing with directors in mind and said, you know, I have a long-standing relationship with this director and I would like that to be honored. Or sometimes we suggest people and say, you know, how about this person to work on the play? Meredith McDonough, who's a fabulous director, is the associate artistic director here. So Meredith is looking for a show too. So, It's always a kind of negotiation with the writer, you know. We want the best production,
right. Now, I know a lot of the plays can shift and change from the beginning of the festival to the end. How has it been this year? Is there a lot of revision and?
Well, there's usually very little revision from the show opening in the festival to the end. Okay. I mean, the shows change according to the audiences nightly, but there's most of the work is done during the rehearsal process.
Okay. Has there been any audience reaction that surprised you in the shows?
Never on a consistent basis.
Okay.
You know, I think it's the night-to-night shifts that are the ones that take us all by surprise. But I don't think that's particular to the festival. I think wherever I've worked, you know.
Right.
The same with actors who will say, you know, we did the performance one night and it was hilarious, and the following night it was greeted with almost silence. What is that? That's always a surprise wherever you are, and it's nothing to do with festivals, non-festivals, geographical location. You know, those are the nightly surprises of the business.
Now, looking ahead to next season, what are you looking forward to there?
next season. I'm looking forward to Meredith's production of both parts of Angels in America at the top of the season.
That should be tremendous.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
And well-timed.
Yes, absolutely.
In addition to the plays I mentioned before, and the 10-minute plays, and a collaborative work written for the Professional Intern Company, there was one more full-length play this year, a show called Airness by Chelsea Marcantel. It's a play about the world of competitive air guitar. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. It sounds crazy on the face of it. That's not a thing. Let me tell you, it is so a thing. My God. People have compared this to the elaborate entrance of Chad Deity by Christopher Diaz in terms of plunging you into a world you did not know and explaining everything you need to know about surviving in that world. Surviving and thriving, no less. When my 15-year-old son asked me, "So, what did you like this year?" And I said, "Well, I liked pretty much everything. But there's one play. If I were going to take you to one play, this would be it." And he said, "Oh, what's it about?" And I said, "Competitive air guitar." And he said, "Nope." And after the fact, he said, "Yeah, all right. You're right. I get it. I get it." So I sat down for an extended interview with playwright Chelsea Marcantel and director Meredith McDonough, who was also the associate artistic director at Actors Theatre.
So can you tell me a little bit about where Airness came from?
Full disclosure, many years ago in my wayward youth, I dated a guy that was a competitive air guitarist when I was living in Chicago. And at the time I thought, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. I can't believe that anyone would spend their real money and their real time doing this imaginary thing. And, the beginning of his air guitar career dovetailed really neatly with the end of our relationship. Hmm. But many years later, with some perspective on it, air guitar came back onto my radar, and I realized as I learned more about it, that I think what it really was for him was less about air guitar, and more about the fact that he had found his people. He had really right. found his tribe. And that became very compelling to me. And the more that I learned about the world of air guitar, the more fascinated I became, and the more I thought this is really fertile ground for play, and also just really fun. It's just like a fun world to live in,
right.
when you're writing. So, yeah, I got really interested in it really fast, and then the rest kind of just spiraled out of control on its own.
Well, and I should say, full disclosure, I love this play. One of the things I loved about it is that it's several things all at once. It is that finding your people story. It's a sports underdog story. Mm-hmm. And it takes all of the things that you recognize from that, and it does them so beautifully. It lays them out, and you don't need to know anything about air guitar or rock music or anything to walk into this play. It gives you everything you need to know, and the audiences seem to just go with it. Now, what were the challenges in directing it? Because not everybody is able to do air guitar.
I mean, it's very true. You know, we all went down this like crazy YouTube wormhole.
Right.
And having Matt Burns, who is the reigning international air guitar champion, as part of your team.
that doesn't hurt.
No. And, you know, he did like... When we were workshopping it in New York, we did a 3-day workshop in New York. He did a very carefully curated YouTube of like, okay, this is why you have to watch this. This is why you have to watch this. This is why you have to watch this. And, you know, I say that these actors are like, it's incredibly brave because Matt Burns like saw air guitar when he was a teenager and was like, I want to do air guitar, and spent his time and years over the past decade learning how to do it incredibly well. And these actors did not have that impulse.
Right.
But they have to look like they had that impulse, which actually means you have to get like comfortable enough with it
that you can do exactly what the play tells us it is. You know, it's an interesting thing, right? It's a play that tells us what Aranis is and then asks you to watch a bunch of people and decide if you think they have it. So it's like, you know, so you actually have to empower like a group of actors to be like, yes, foolishness is welcome. And you do have to look like a kid that like the joy of spazzing out in your room and like really going there and getting like gradually bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger to own the size of what like the heart of the thing is.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, that was a great moment where the idea that it's when looking back to when you were a child and being able to access that, which I mean, there's this sort of strain of the importance of pretend, the importance of play, and how not everyone has that and not everyone accesses that. And maybe more people should. Which that was one of those things that as I'm sitting there, I'm going, subtext! Ah! Yikes! Because you think, oh, this is just air guitar, right? So that was delightful, too. I'm trying to think of other questions.
Well, you know, piggybacking off what you just said, like, I do think, like, in this... It's funny, right? Like, you pick a play. Like, I read the play and was like, this is delightful. I would yes. love to do this play. Because, you know, it's actually rare. Like, you know, contemporary new comedy that's, like, feel-good comedy. There's not, like, a bazillion of them floating around.
Right.
You know, it's like...
Right.
And so when you actually read it and you're like, yes! Like... But I will say, like, you know, we picked this play when Obama was still president, and like, you actually look at now, I think, like, the act of that sort of like public vulnerability is like exactly what the American theater needs right now, is that like strangers should like come together and sit in a space and like make a pact to watch a story together.
Right.
And then when that story is something that is filled with such like unbridled joy and just like, here's what vulnerability looks like. Remember what it looked like to not be scared.
Mm.
Like, I think is actually like incredibly, I think goes to why like the little old lady next to you loves it in the same way that like that 12-year-old that someone brought loves it.
Right.
Because there's something about an identification that I think is really important right now.
Yeah, and I like that you compared it to like a sports underdog movie, because that was a lot of what we talked about in rehearsal, about the feeling of it,
right.
And the, specifically like the movies from that we watched in our childhoods, like the Mighty Ducks movies and Bad News Bears, mm-hmm. and the movies where it's sort of like, it's about winning a championship, but it's really more about like what we learn about each other and ourselves on the way to the championship.
Right.
And how much stronger we are as a unit, and how much stronger we are when we embrace our differences and build each other up instead of tear each other down, which shouldn't feel like a political statement, but does now.
Yeah.
The idea that people are stronger as a group, and that if we embrace our differences, it makes us all better people, shouldn't be controversial to say, but now kind of feels like a political statement. But that makes me even prouder that it's sort of like, yes, it's about air guitar, and yes, there's like a lot of glitter, and there's, you know, a lot of loud music, and I hope that you'll clap your hands and get very excited about all the sparkly things. But at the end, if you walk out feeling like, I feel good about myself, and I feel good about my friends, and I feel like there's potential, and there are good things in life, and joy is real, then I feel like that's really why you've given us 90 minutes of your life, and we can give you something back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to say, I hope this play establishes the Chekhov's Nancy Wilson rule. Because the second time Nancy Wilson came up, I'm like, okay, we're going to hear some. I know we're going to hear some.
I'm just trying to get on Nancy Wilson's radar. This, yes. This is what this all has been about.
It's the long game.
The long game is it like, yes. Nancy Wilson retweets something about it, we all lose our minds.
No, you know what my real long game is, and maybe this is a taboo to say in an American theater interview, but like my long game is that one day there will be a movie and Nancy Wilson will write the score because she composes film scores.
There you go.
That's my...
and now you've put that into the world.
Yes.
And yes. It's okay.
Yeah, we can see that.
We have... Yeah, I think it would be a delightful movie. I would love to see that. I mean, how much of what they use to teach, how much of the mentorship is really part of air guitar, and how much of it did you just come up with?
None of anything that's in it is made up or not real. A couple of things, we have adjusted the timeline for urgency
on
how things happen in a season. But for the most part, all of the rules and the things that they say to each other, the advice they give is all real. And then also the spirit of mentorship is like the spirit of the community.
Right.
The idea that as soon as a person comes in and expresses a modicum of interest, everyone is like, let me help you be the best version of yourself. Mm-hmm. And even with competitors who have been in the game a long time, it's like, what are you playing this season? What are you going to wear? Well, oh, that's interesting. Have you thought about this cut? So it's a constant sort of like, you know, the I write plays about small groups of people a lot. It's kind of my major area of what interests me as a writer. And a lot of times a problem that I have getting exposition to the audience, getting them what they need to know is that, like, for instance, I have a play about Amish people don't sit around and talk about being Amish.
Right.
So it's kind of hard to get the exposition out there. Right. Air guitarists sit around and talk about air guitar ad nauseum.
Yeah.
That is what they talk to each other about. So the idea that they're all just going to sit in a bar and talk about air guitar for hours is so true to life that it made my job much easier in getting the audience the exposition that they need to have to understand what's going on. And it's always in a spirit of like making everyone better.
Yeah.
It's never in a spirit of like, I know more than you, or you should listen to me because I've got a beat on this that you don't have, which is why when we have a character that does that, he's the villain character. You know?
Right. Right. One, I have to say, I loved the set design and set changes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best use of Living on a Prayer I've ever heard.
Yes.
If Bon Jovi exists just for that scene change, yes. I'm okay. How did you come up with how to stage it? And
I mean, Jenny Koons, I have to give a huge shout out to, who's our movement director.
Yes.
The crazy thing about being in this particular slot in the festival is that we rehearsed on the set because...
Oh, right. Because the Victor Jory, you don't have to change.
Right. We don't have to change it. And logistically, because we're the last show to go into tech, they have to build our set before all the other sets because they have to do 4 techs. Like, our tech crew here has to do 4 techs before they get to us.
Right.
So they wouldn't have any time to load ours in. So they load ours in before they begin loading in the others.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
Okay.
And so, you know, the first couple of days, we're like a walking panic attack because myself and the actors, none of us are used to that. So you feel like there's something intrinsic where you're like, oh, I'm on the set. I must be starting tech.
Right.
Except, and I would have these like, I was like, you guys, I'm having like basically a low-lying panic attack because I don't understand why you're not off book yet.
And one day it was very cold and we turned on some lights to warm it up. And that was the day that everyone was like, no, there cannot be lights.
No,
lights is too much.
Yeah, because you honestly, you can't stop yourself, myself and actors, of people being like, is it going to be like this? And you're like, I don't know. We're the first week of rehearsal. But like but the amazing thing towards the end of, you know, when like Debo, the set designer, and I were talking about it, I said, it should feel like roadies. Like, this is a world where these people like bring their own stuff. They pack up their own costumes. Everyone, you know, like you sort of pack up your car and go to the next place. And I was like, so the world should feel like that,
right.
That like, we're like, all right, that little stage is done. Let's like pack it up and like move it over and bring out a bigger stage and bring, you know, so that there was something energetically that it was like, it's always a dive bar, but you have to feel it get bigger.
Right.
And
it worked.
Thank you. But it was really, you know, it was sort of the joy of being able to figure it out so you could actually do it with music in the room. And right. then, like, that amazing Bon Jovi transition that you're talking about, which, again, I have to give you a huge shout out to Jenny, is this is, like, the perfect play where we would frequently turn to each other and be like, is this too stupid or exactly right?
Exactly right.
Yes.
Is the obvious joke actually the best joke? And so this was like, we're halfway through the play.
And then they say, we're halfway there.
Yeah.
And literally.
I did look at my watch and go, oh my God, yes they are.
So. Yeah. So it's like, and Jenny was also like, in this play, I think we need to watch the roadies play air guitar once.
Yeah.
Like, I think you need to see the crew do it once. And then go away.
Do you know what I realized, though, is that Matt Burns is in that transition.
Yes.
He is playing the air triangle.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the air drums.
He is not playing the air guitar in that transition. He is saving himself.
Yes. Well, I told him, I was like, you can't, because he was playing and I was like, uh-uh.
You can't show up
anybody. And he was like, oh, I can play left-handed. And I was like,
doing this weird left-handed
version.
He'll still be better than everyone else in the world.
Yeah.
Really in the world. But my hope is that, like, we teach everyone enough about air guitar in 90 minutes that they understand, not just like that the actors are really good at it, because they are really good at it. They're not faking it. They're really doing it.
Right.
And then also that you can sort of appreciate the nuances in their styles and how they're different. And then that if you go home and you watch YouTube clips, you might have opinions about things. This happened when you were with the book club.
Yes.
Yes. This is a great story.
We had a board member who every year, her book club, she like picks a play, and I frequently have directed the play that they pick, and they read the play, like the book, you know, for that month. And then I come in and we like talk about it. And so they read Erinus, and I was like, and it was this year, it was both her book club and her Mahjong group. And so it was a group of like 15 ladies in their mid 60s and who were like, and the first thing they were like, wait, this is a real thing? And I was like, oh yeah. And I'm sitting in front of this like enormous television. It was like that, like enormous television. And they're like, wait, can we pull it up on YouTube? So now all of a sudden I'm like, okay, so what you're going to see here in this performance, that, wait, so who else? And I was like, oh, well, Nordic Thunder's another one that's really good to watch. So they were watching that and they're like, I don't know. I thought he was better than the other one. And like, they got like very into, and I was like, yeah, I could fully be a judge. Yeah. Like at this point I could be a
great
judge.
That is my great hope for my real life, is that I'll be asked to judge an air guitar.
Yes.
Just a small one. I don't need to judge nationals or the semifinals, but I feel like I know enough.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got the chops now.
Yeah, and I'm articulate with feedback.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing that was impressive, was just how well they did it. I mean, I know there's a lot of movement and choreography and training and all that, but there's some things you can't fake.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it's not true airness compared to real air guitar players, but they didn't look like they were trying to remember moves. They were just into it.
And part of that is the way we built the show, because Jenny Coons, I feel like she should be here with us. She's so integral to this whole thing. But it would have felt totally disingenuous to the world of air guitar to have a choreographer choreograph 7 solos and then be like, here they are, I'll teach them to you. Just replicate this.
Right.
So we had she worked one-on-one with the actors, and they worked with each other to develop their 60-second routines. So the actors fully own those routines because they were the co-creators of them. Mm. And they, in some cases, in many cases, worked on the song cut, and they collaborated on their costumes with Allison Seipel, our costume designer. So everything about what they're doing and wearing and saying wasn't put on them.
Right.
They helped in the creation of it, which feels very true to the world. And also when you're watching them on stage, they don't look like puppets that we dressed and taught routines. You know, they look like people who who are creators of the thing. And the being a creator is what Airdus is about. It's right. about when you stop pretending to do a thing and you start actually doing something.
Right. Well, I was just going to ask, how much did they have input in terms of costume and music? And
yeah. I picked the songs, with the exception of Golden Thunder's Supercut of Ultimate Unity. all the songs that they do were songs that I picked and have not really changed since the first draft of the script.
Wow.
Number one, now I get to foist my musical taste on everyone.
Nancy Wilson.
And number two, I thought really long and hard about dramaturgically how all the songs work.
Right.
So when we were going into new drafts and adding a few things like new little scenes that we were going to need songs for, or songs in transitions, it was sort of like, yeah, this song is great, but how does it speak to the other song? I mean, it's a whole dramaturgical element, like lyrically and in terms of tempo and in terms of just like what instruments are used. How are the songs speaking to each other and what do they tell us about the characters? So not for nothing, I'm married to a sound designer, so I had some help. I played God with the songs for the most part, yeah, but everything else was really like the actors were in it from day one.
Yeah, see, I also do sound design too, so I very much appreciated the because it all made sense. It was like, yes, this is the right song. Yeah, I'm trying to think what else. I should prepare more.
I feel like we've given a shout out to all of our great. Well, I mean, Lindsay Jones did our sound, and Paul Tobin did our lights, which were like massive technical components. Especially toward the end when the venues start getting bigger and bigger.
Right. But the lighting was amazing.
The lighting. When I walked into the space the first day, I was like, are we storing lights in here? This is more lights than every other show I've ever done put together.
Yes.
And Meredith was like, you wrote it.
Yeah. I was like, there was the moment where they're like, all of the lights come on when they're in LA. And I was like, I feel like all the lights are going to come on and Louisville is going to have like a blackout. Nope, shut it down.
Yeah, I mean, I walked in and I was sitting straight on and I just kind of looked up and went, holy crap. And I knew they weren't there just for decoration. Right, it's like, nope, they're all, we're going to see those.
All these lights are coming up. That's an example of someone taking stage directions very literally. Because it was just like I wrote in all caps, lights come up in a big way, period. And then 4 million lights manifested in the Victor Jory Theater.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really, I mean, it's such a, it is the thing I learned about, you know, rock concerts, is it's the thing, is that you program everything and then you run it through, you know, you run it through the soundboard.
Right.
So it's not like, it's like when it starts, it goes, because there's no need to call anything because it's not going to change. Like, the song isn't going to stop or change, which is not even true in musicals because you're like, no, in musicals, you're still calling things because it can still shift. Right. But with this, you're like, nope, it just goes, which is so satisfying because you can make the lights. Like, there's never a moment of being like, oh, that was a little late call. Oh, that was like, nope, it's perfect.
Just going.
It was.
Perfect.
It was.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Now, how does this compare to some of your other plays?
It's very, very different. like I said, all of my plays are about, what I'm interested in as a writer is humans as small group primates. So, like, when we find our tribe, what if they won't let us in? Or what if once we're in, the rules stop working? Or what if we go away for a long time? What does it feel like to try to come back and get back in? All of my plays are about sort of small groups of people with their own value systems. Aragatar may be on the sort of like most extreme side as far as things that are absurd and funny. I have a production this summer of a play that's about an Amish family that's like dealing with tragedy, which is very different. and I have a play about people building a tiny house, and I'm writing a play now about girls in America who are trying to join ISIS on the internet. So like everyone is very different. I'm going to go out on a limb and say my funniest play. My father would tell you it's my funniest play. He told me several times. And therefore best in his opinion.
Yes, of course. Mm. Of course.
But this is, I will say I've never had so much fun in rehearsal.
Yeah. Like my face would hurt at the end of the day from laughing. And I don't.
I've heard that from a lot of audience members.
Yeah. Just like, when we opened, people were like, what was the rehearsal process like? And I was like, I could tell you it was really hard. But that would be a lie. Like, there were times where we struggled with stuff and we had to sort of, like, all put our heads together to fix things. But for the most part, it was just, like, a blast every day.
Mm.
Yeah. And I don't think I've written any other place that I can say that the rehearsal process has been so much fun every single day.
Mm.
Yeah.
And, it shows just the chemistry between everybody. It's one of the tightest ensembles I've seen here.
Yeah.
And I've come a lot.
Yeah.
So.
And I think it is. It's like truly, you know, they did hour-long warm-ups every day. A, because like air guitar is actually physically taxing. Like your neck, like we had people pull muscles. We had people pull, you know, like you pull like, oh, you pull your groin muscle. You pull your neck muscle. You pull like, because you thrash around and your body's not used to that. So it was like the warm-ups they did and then just like building like. Jenny would be like, okay, we're going to do like air band. And so like people would just get, you just have to like get up and go. You just have to do it. It's like that. It's like the spirit of like a really good improv troupe.
Right.
That like, you just have to get up and do it. And you know, it's like where people would be like, what am I supposed to do? You know, it's like your brain wants to do like 8,000 things to say like, I'm afraid I'm going to be foolish.
Right.
And we're just like, we just don't care.
Yeah.
You go be foolish. It's going to be great. And when you sort of break through that all, then you really are like, yeah, what are we doing today? Like, and that's where you suddenly turn into like, that is the joy of small children.
Right.
That are like, what are we doing today? What are we doing today? Which is great.
Yeah. I mean, it's, if I had to choose two words, I would say it's just joyous and infectious. It's
Yeah,
I do not dance, and I walked out. I was like, where's Timberlake? Give me Timberlake. I need to do something. And it was just, you know, I don't do that. So nice job.
Awesome.
So there you have it. A quick report from the 41st annual Humana Festival of New American Plays at Actors Theatre of Louisville. I'm David J. Lohr, and I will see you online.
We're back with recommendations. We had a lively conversation while Dave's interview was going on. Russ, why don't you start us off with your recommendation?
Sure. I am going to recommend the new Pulitzer Prize winner, Sweat, transferred to Broadway from the Public Theater. I'm sure we'll be seeing it at many places around the country in the coming seasons. We look forward to it. I left my seat at the end of Act Two saying, I hope that gets the Pulitzer. So pleased that it did. Also, a couple of bits of trivia about that win. First female playwright to win the Pulitzer twice. And we're pretty sure that this makes Lynn Ottage the first woman of color to win two Pulitzers in any category.
I think that's right. I think the Pulitzer was putting out that news themselves, but I'm not sure. So it's a milestone.
Yeah.
And I you know.
And for the record, Susie and I were right last week. So go us.
You mean in betting that Sweat would win. And I was saying Dear Evan Hansen. Yeah.
Oh.
I was wrong.
Well, it was also because of we're betting that Sweat would probably win, and we were talking about Taylor Mack.
As a finalist? Yeah.
Yeah, and you said no, so ha!
Oh, you said no about both?
I guess I did. I don't remember. You got the tape. You got the tape showing me to be an idiot, so. The other finalist was...
Sarah DeLapp's The Wolves.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, that was like a dark horse. I did not see that one coming.
It's a good play.
It was a very good play. I was actually quite happy this year.
It's all positive.
Aside from Hilton Owls, apparently, according to some people.
It's a milestone that he got that, though. I mean, they haven't given it to a drama critic
in a very long time.
For journalism since 1978. And I will bracket my problems with Hilton Owls to say congratulations. And for drama, yay for drama criticism and yay for drama criticism of color. I mean, you know, I cannot discount, even though I've had so many problems with his reviews over the years. Even before he was a theater critic, he drove me nuts at The New Yorker as a writer, just as a culture writer. But he's an inspiration to many people, and I don't. And he's also talk about finding artists and holding them up. He's shown the light on many great artists in a venue where it made a difference.
His reviews aren't always good, but every so often he turns out a very beautiful piece of writing. So you know,
he's a beautiful writer.
Yeah, you can't hate the man for doing his job well.
Okay, so Dee, what do you have to recommend?
Okay, well, I know you guys did a podcast on Sondheim while I was in Russia or I was somewhere. But that doesn't matter because I recently saw Norm Lewis do Sweeney Todd at the Barrow Street in an open-ended run off Broadway, and I had a great time. So that's my recommendation. And it's also because Sweeney Todd's one of my favorite Sondheim musicals.
It's a great production.
Yeah.
It's probably really the great musical ever.
Yes.
But
that and Gypsy, right?
You know. But they're both up there. Guys and Dolls, Gypsy, Sweeney Todd.
No, it just makes me really, really happy to just like see actors of color, you know, minority actors get lead roles and do it very well. And also the actor who played Toby was also African American. So it was just, and the actor who played Pirelli was a woman. So they're just doing some really interesting things with casting there that didn't take away from the story, because the story isn't about race. It's just about the horrible ways people treat each other.
Probably added to it. I didn't see that cast, but I imagine that it actually added to the production.
Oh, yeah. It totally did because, you know.
Donald, I just point out
that. Supremacy and stuff like that.
You've given me an idea for my recommendation, which I didn't have until this moment.
Wow.
And by the way, bracket, Donna Lynn Champlin did Pirelli in the John Doe production. She was great. So anyway, that's a little sidebar. But I would just say that speaking of, I think this is true, that the very first Sweeney Todd I saw on a stage live was at East West Players. Mm. And Orville Mendoza was a wonderful Sweeney Todd. And then I saw him a couple years, that was in 94. In 98, I know because I just reposted these reviews. In 98, I saw him as Kayama in what for me was the definitive production of Pacific Overtures when East West Players opened this new space in Little Tokyo, the David Henry Wong Theater. It was a definitive production. He was amazing in it. And then I saw him in Roadshow. So I've basically seen him mostly in Sondheim shows. He's been one of the central Sondheim interpreters of my life. Did not see him in that. Was he in that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I did not see him. So he's a Sondheim.
No one wants to see.
He's a Sondheim guy.
John Doyle Passion.
I heard that was good. Yeah. So this is all. This is which to say is he's been cast as Manjiro, which is the other sort of lead opposite Kayama in the new production of Pacific Overtures at Classic Stage Company, and I don't know if it's a good production, but I am eagerly anticipating seeing.
Oh, the cast same here. Makes me so excited.
Yeah, George Sakai is the reciter. And
Anne Harada is in it too.
Right, right. No, I think it's one of the most underrated Sondheim shows. You know, I think it's a masterpiece. It's one of my maybe top five, maybe top 10. I don't know what my numbers are for these of shows, musicals of all time. And, so even if they screw it up, I'm so excited to see it. And so excited to see Orville after all these years. He's one of the great musical theater guys. So that's my pre-recommendation. I will seeing it. And, you know, again, even if this production doesn't turn out to work, who knows? You never know. You can never tell. I recommend Pacific Overtures in general.
You can never tell with John Doyle, so.
He's had a pretty good track record lately. Color Purple was great, you know. You know, I think people are hot and cold on it. And you know, people playing instruments is part of the staging, so it's.
Wait, they're playing instruments this time too?
I don't know, but like in the version I saw with Keone Young, the reciter played the shamisen and.
Interesting, because when I saw John Doyle do Passion, they weren't playing instruments.
No.
It was just people laying on the floor.
I'm just saying, if there's a Sondheim show, if there's a Sondheim show where it would make sense to have people play instruments, I think in the East West Players version, some of the people, the actors were playing instruments because it uses some Japanese theater techniques that are part of the staging, that were part of the Harold Prince staging, and then the Tim Dang staging at East West used it. I would be surprised if John Doyle does not glom onto that aspect because he does like sort of sparse Brechtian theater techniques. I'll be shocked if there's not some like meta theatrical, you know, instrument playing.
Because unlike Bublil and Schoenberg, Sondheim actually did his research. Okay.
John Weidman. Let's give John Weidman a shout
out. John Weidman, absolutely.
All right. On that note, Vietgon is not the anti-Mistagon. It's Pacific Overtures is the anti-Mistagon. If you're going to take another play by white guys that gets Asia right?
Yep.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that next show. Didn't even talk about our international issue, which just came out, our May June issue, which is about theater in China.
Now on newsstands.
Now on newsstands. Look for that, and we'll talk about that probably on our next podcast.
Yeah.
All the things we talked about will be linked. You know, rate us on iTunes. Send us your thoughts.
Yeah. We take comments. Yeah. We may not always read them, but we'll take them.
We take them.
All right. See you next time.
All right.
See you at the theater. Thank you.